When you wake up in the morning, you hear the big bell ring. Go up into the table, see the same old thing, a knife, a fork on the table. Nothing in my pants. If I say a thing about it, I'm in trouble with the man who left the midnight special. Shine a light on me and live the midnight special. Shine a ever-loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, you better walk right. You better not stagger. You better not fight the sheriff. He will arrest you. He gonna carry you down. And when the jury find you guilty, your penitentiary bound. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a ever-loving light on me. I'm the come Miss Rosie. Well, how the world did you know? Oh, well, I know the about April. And the dress she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, a piece of paper in her hand. Goes out walking to the captain, said, turn her loose on my man. Lift the midnight special, shine a light on me. Lift the midnight special, shine a ever-loving light on me. Well, it's jumping, jumping, jumping. That was the whip. She's a mighty fine gal. She brought jumping to the whole wide world. She was a mighty fine gal. She brought that in a morning. I jumped a little for day. She brought me the news that my wife was dead. Big night special, shine a light on me. Live the midnight special, shine a ever-loving light on me. The light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. It's a little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This is the light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Thanks
for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area or on accesssacramento.org, or you can download this program at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, the rest of the interview between Rebecca Spooner and Red Eye host Jane Williams about the uncontacted tribes in Peru who are threatened by the energy industry. And then later after that, Years of Living Dangerously, Hollywood director James Cameron is interviewed by Steve Curwood about his documentary, Years of Living Dangerously.
What approach are the companies taking to the presence of Indigenous peoples, the Canadian company and the other companies in the area?
They have pretty much ignored the calls. They've got a protocol that they say that they've got procedures that they will carry out if there is any contact with the uncontacted Indians. But the problem is you can't avoid contact. You never know where an uncontacted tribe is at any one time because they're nomadic people. So they're moving across a large distance very quickly. And there's not really anything that you can do to prevent hostility, violence, or the spread of disease. So, you know, they're not doing enough. The only thing that they can responsibly do is cease all work in the region where they know there are uncontacted Indians.
What's the scope of the protest that's been mounted against this most recent instance of uncontacted tribes being contacted?
Well, there's been a huge, Survival's been running an international campaign for many years now, and there's been a really positive response. There's been over 130,000 people who have signed a petition asking the Peruvian and Brazilian governments to act to protect these areas. There have, you know, many institutions are calling for this, and it's something that is being brought into legislation. There is good legislation in both Peru and Brazil for these uncontacted tribes. But, you know, there's so many loopholes in the law. They say, for example, that these are intangible protected reserves for the rights of the uncontacted tribes. But then at the same time, they say the government owns everything so all of the subsoil belongs to the government. So they can go into an area that is protected, supposedly, and, you know, take out the resources, oil and gas. Gold mining is a huge issue. So the lands are sort of on paper protected, but in reality, they're not being protected at all.
Now, I understand that the last year Peruvian President Humala demanded a halt to oil and gas work in uncontacted tribal land.
No. Well, we would have liked that. That was what our campaign was for. Humala did bring in a good law, which is, so he ratified the only international law for tribal people's rights, which gives them the right to consultation on any development project that may affect their land. However, it's a complicated issue with uncontacted Indians because obviously they can't be contacted to consult them. So that law really doesn't benefit uncontacted tribes at all. And very sadly and very frustratingly, Humala's government gave the green light to the Camisea gas project, which is the country's largest gas project, which lies right in the heart of an uncontacted tribes reserve just some months ago. So, you know, he's giving with one hand and taking with the other.
Now, you mentioned earlier that a Canadian company is involved. What do you think people here in Canada can do to show that they don't think that this should happen?
Well, I think it's really important that people start writing to the company, Pacific Ubialis. You know, I'm in constant contact with the Matsez tribe, who is a tribe that was contacted in the 1970s. By missionaries, and this was because their land was being taken over for road projects and other things, oil and logging. And so at that time, they were forced into contact by missionaries, and, you know, it was disastrous, as it always is. They are now saying, you know, we know that there are uncontacted Indians just south of our territory. The oil company is trying to not only take our land, but it's trying to take the land of the uncontacted tribe, and they're wholeheartedly rejecting the work. But the problem is, with indigenous people in places like Peru, they really don't have a strong enough voice. They're not really truly represented in government. So it's very important, and it's, in fact, it can be very successful if the international community comes together, writes to companies that are, you know, particularly when there is a connection in Canada. Canadians write to Pacific Ruralis and express their dismay at the fact that it's working in an area which, you know, their work threatens to wipe out an entire people. Then perhaps the company will start to listen.
And people would find that name and contact information on your website?
Yeah, so if people go to survivalinternational.org, people can find out about all of our campaigns. We've got campaigns all over the world, not just in the Amazon region. And in this particular case, yes, they can look up Pacific Rubialis or the tribe pages called Matez, and they'll be able to find all the information there.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for talking to me today.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Rebecca Spooner. She's a campaigner with Survival International, which specializes in defending the rights of Indigenous people around the world.
Just about a year ago, I set out on the road, seeking my fame and fortune, looking for a pot of gold. Things got bad and things got worse, I guess you know the tune. Oh Lord, stuck in
that everything we thought we knew on climate change has actually been underestimated, that the effects of climate change will be upon us faster or in an intense fashion than we had thought.
The cable TV series Years of Living Dangerously won a 2014 Emmy for Outstanding Nonfiction. It's a high-profile, highly produced, and highly praised investigation into the impacts of climate change worldwide, hosted by respected journalists such as Leslie Stahl and Tom Friedman, and celebrity correspondents that include actors Harrison Ford, Don Cheadle, and Matt Damon. James Cameron is an executive producer. He's perhaps better known for blockbuster films such as Titanic and Avatar. This series first aired on Showtime, a premium cable channel which limited its audience. Now, though, it's out on DVD and iTunes, and James Cameron joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us about when climate change became an important issue for you.
I think pretty much as soon as I first started reading about it, you know, going back 15, 20 years, and just this kind of growing awareness that there were all these environmental problems and climate change was one of them. And it began to emerge, I think, as the preeminent one that affected all the other systems and, you know, all the other aspects of, you know, the ocean, the terrestrial ecosystems. And then it came into kind of preeminent focus for me. And this would have been, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
So let's turn to the production of The Years of Living Dangerously. Tell me, how does using celebrities as the correspondents in this series help communicate them better than, say, using someone boring like a no-name journalist?
Well, we wanted to reach beyond just preaching to the choir. You know, documentaries in general, and certainly anything on the environment, tend to not be very effective in getting out there to people who may be skeptical or disinterested. Obviously, the climate crisis affects us all across all political boundaries. And so we wanted to reach everybody, which is a lofty goal and one that's probably not really attainable. But we thought, how can we, what kind of hooks can we use to make good, compelling television and also to get people to watch it? And so the idea of incorporating, you know, Hollywood celebrities and other, you know, music celebrities and so on, sports, into this was brought to me by Joel Bach and David Gelber, the originators of the series. And I was skeptical at first. I thought, you know, people shouldn't listen to celebrities. You know, they their lines are written down for them. But Joel and David said, no, we're not going to put them in as talking heads, as supposed experts, because they're not climate experts. Let's have them be concerned citizens, curious and wanting answers, and with the kind of compassion that actors can get to in dealing with human issues. And so let's let them roll their sleeves up and go out there into the field and see what's happening to people right now. And I thought, okay, that makes sense.
What were you surprised to learn or see when you were making this series?
Well, I mean, I wasn't surprised by the horror of what's happening out there, because I, you know, I knew the facts going into it. I was surprised, I think, at how effective our celebrity journalists were at getting great stories out of people on the ground out there, you know, such as the minister in Indonesia when Harrison Ford confronted him.
Finally, I'm meeting the forestry minister. I have a lot of questions.
We were in Tesonilo.
Tesonilo.
National Park.
Okay.
It's not funny.
Yeah.
It's not funny. Only 18% of it remains. We saw it. There are new roads, new illegal roads. Forests cut, trees laying on the ground, burnt where they fell. It's devastating. It's heartbreaking to see it.
You know, it's some pretty strong television. And the thing that I think that Joel and David did deliver was good investigative journalism and really strong, compelling TV.
So, Jim, what other places do you think a celebrity really made a difference in what you were able to get in terms of a response?
I think in every segment. I think in every segment they make a difference both in the viewer's level of interest and the number of people that show up. And I think they made a difference in situ in the dialogues that they were having. Some other journalist might not have gotten that interview with that minister in Indonesia. And I think we should stress here, because we've been talking celebrity, we also had Tom Friedman and Leslie Stahl and Mark Bittman and Chris Hayes and other solid journalists as well. This wasn't all just celebrity TV. But I think, you know, in terms of the effectiveness of the show, when you've got Don Cheadle tearing up, hearing the story of the people that he's talking to, and you feel his compassion for them, it can't help but evoke compassion on the part of viewer.
Oh, let's play a bit of Don Cheadle here.
It's your spirit that...
In a lot of the country, something like a drought is seen as an act of God or part of a natural cycle. But where I live, in Los Angeles, it seems like any kind of extreme weather gets blamed on climate change. Sometimes it feels like we live in two different countries. I want to know what the truth is about this drought.
Look at that.
And if it's possible for these two sides to talk to each other. So I'm heading to Texas to find out.
And I think that's what this is all about. Climate change is going to affect everybody on the planet, but it's going to affect a lot of poor people, a lot of farmers, a lot of people are going to have their lives hit a lot harder than people who are sheltered in urban environments. And I think that part of what people need to do to really confront this challenge is to open up and be compassionate for the people that are going to be on the front lines of this crisis in the future.
How does your awareness of the climate emergency, so many environmental changes that threaten us now, how does that affect your work in the craft of making films? What do you do, for example, to reduce the carbon footprint of the kind of work you do?
Well, I'm making three sequels to Avatar right now, which are any individual one of them is a mega production, and we're doing three of them sort of together as one big production. And we're operating out of a studio in Manhattan Beach here in Los Angeles. And we took the sound stages and we put a 1 megawatt solar power generating station essentially on the roof. So we will be net carbon neutral in all of our production activities here in terms of power consumption. So we took the initiative to essentially to generate our own power. And, you know, we'll run a very green set and that sort of thing. So that's the kind of thing that you can do to take a stand as a business person. And I try to live my life as green as I possibly can. My food carbon footprint's very low because I live on a 100% plant-based diet. I think you have to lead by example. You know, you can't just be spouting off, and I think that's where celebrities really trip themselves up, is when they spout off about a problem and then they go live a profligate life.
Sun-powered 3D film, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep, we're solar-powered.
So what are you thinking about in terms of putting, say, a cli-fi movie in your future?
I don't even know what that is. What did you call it?
A cli-fi, you know, climate fiction movie.
Oh, cli-fi, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the Avatar sequels are about essentially the future of humanity and the future of life on Pandora and how those two are commingled. So, you know, what's happening on the Earth 150 years from now is very much a part of that story. And, of course, climate dominates that, climate and resource depletion and so on. So that'll be part of it.
Jim Cameron is one of the executive producers of Years of Living Dangerously. Jim, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
I appreciate it.
Give God your glory.
let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Always know, sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
That's all, folks.